books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today's show has a festive feel as we chat to Peter Swanson about The Christmas Guest. Plus we'll hear from comedian Tony Hawks and we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB Talking Books library, one of which is by Judy Dench. All that and more on today's Read On. New York Times best-selling author Peter Swanson's book, The Christmas Guest, is a spine-chilling novella in which an American art student in London is invited to join a classmate for the holidays at her family's cottage, in inverted commas, in the Cotswolds. But behind the holly and the pine, secrets are about to unravel, revealing the seemingly charming English village's grim history. It's told over two time periods, and I'll be joined by author Peter Swanson in a moment for a spoiler-free chat about the book, the audio version of which is read by Esther Wayne.
Since I have no family of my own, I am yearly asked by friends and colleagues to their homes for the Christmas holidays. I always say no, pleading my case that I am perfectly content to be alone for a week. And mostly I am. I read a good book, maybe re-watch some of my favourite films. On Christmas Day, I roast a chicken and eat it with crispy potatoes and Brussels sprouts. My cat, Elspeth, likes a bit of roast chicken too, and I let her sit on the kitchen counter as a special treat. In the afternoon, I often clean my apartment or reorganise my bookshelves. Sometimes, if the weather is nice, I'll take a walk across Manhattan, see if there is a movie playing that looks interesting. I am not completely alone. The doorman, Howard, and I usually find time for a glass of whiskey, and I have a close friend, also without family, who often drops by, although she hasn't for the past couple of years. This year, Christmas Day has arrived on the heels of a wet, sleety nor'easter that rattles the windows of my apartment. So after my roast chicken, I decide to skip the walk and tackle my bedroom closet.
Well, The Christmas Guest is my first published, well, novella or short novel. It is about an American student in 1989. Her name is Ashley Smith. She's studying in London, which, you know, American students are wont to do, their junior year of college. And she's not going home over the Christmas break because she has no family to return to. So she's lucky enough to, or unlucky enough to be invited by a new friend, an English friend, to her family's cottage in the Cotswolds for Christmas holiday. And we learn the first sort of half of the story through her diary entries. And I won't say much more about that, except that it's got all the Christmas trimmings, the story, the cottage, the dusting of snow, the Christmas Carol, so on. And then it also has a lot of creepy things happening around the house. And that is what the story is about.
I flip through the pages, arriving at an entry from December 1989, exactly 30 years ago. I decide to take a look, not entirely sure that I'm prepared to go back in time to that annus horribilis, that murderous year, but also knowing that once I start to read, I won't be able to stop.
Yes, one of those books we can't really scratch the surface too much or we'll give away some spoilers.
Yeah, exactly.
But is the festive season a good background for a good gothic thriller?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think actually it's maybe a little more common in the UK. I was actually asked by my editor in the UK at Faber if I wanted to write a Christmas book because they'd been publishing kind of Christmas thrillers the past few years and wanted to know if I wanted to try my hand at one. And I said, I'd like to. And when I mentioned it to my American publisher, they were quite confused. Is this your regular book will be set at Christmas? It will be cozier than normal? Or, you know, they had a bunch of questions. They didn't quite understand the idea of a Christmas thriller. But I think the UK, I mean, I think there's a long tradition, maybe not that long, but, you know, of Christmas specials for TV series. sitcoms, but also Doctor Who, things like that. The Doctor Who ones, the ones I've seen anyway, are quite creepy. So yeah, I think it all has to do with sort of cozying up for Christmas and then reading a sort of dark tale. I mean, it all starts from Charles Dickens, of course, Christmas Carol.
That's what I was going to ask. There's a nod to Charles Dickens in the book. Was he part of the inspiration?
Yeah, I mean, not in the beginning, but then as I continued to write, it sort of came up. I mean, I think Christmas is an interesting time because presented as this joyful time for everyone. But of course, what Christmases do is they remind you of past Christmases because, you know, there's this conformity to them and the way we celebrate, so that if you've lost someone or if you've had a bad experience at Christmas or past trauma or something, that Christmas can be a very triggering event because, you know, it's the same thing every year, the same songs, the same Christmas trees, the same decorations, which of course is Christmas Carol. I mean, it's the ghosts of Christmas past visit us all to a certain degree. And depending on your experience with the holiday, it can be good or it can be bad. So I think that was one of the ideas I was thinking about when I was writing this book, was that Christmas might not be a good reminder for everyone. I mean, that's how the book starts off, with a woman in New York City remembering back to 1989, but also kind of avoiding celebrating Christmas herself.
And she quotes L.P. Hartley from the Go-Between as well.
Yeah, a couple quotes there. Past is a different country. In this case, it's literally true. She's in New York and she's remembering 30 years earlier, a Christmas period in England. I like that idea of remembering back to an earlier part of your life when you felt like a different person. And again, it's tied in with the Christmas as well, because we all have Christmas memories, you know, our own childhoods, so on.
There is a famous quote. The first line from L.P. Hartley's The Go-Between, a book about remembering. Although every book is a book about remembering, isn't it? The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. In my case, the past really is a foreign country. And yes, they do things very differently there. December 17th. Emma Chapman, the one who looks like me, has invited me to her house for Christmas. I tried to be cool and pause for 5 seconds, pretending to consider my options, but I don't think I fooled her. So I just went ahead and accepted, and she looked pleased. She told me that it would be her parents, who were Satan's spawn, her twin brother, who was basically nice, plus a host of friends and endless cousins. Not too many, she said. I know I've mentioned Emma to you, dear diary. Met her during orientation week. Wears cashmere and jewelry that looks like stuff I'll never in my lifetime be able to afford. Sounds posh, or at least that's what other students say. Every time we talk, I say something stupid that I end up repeating in my head again and again.
Now, the audio version is read by Esther Wayne. How involved in the audio recording were you?
I would say I'm 99% not involved. I often am sent a few finalists for the readers, and they ask for my opinion. I don't exactly choose, but I can say, you know, I quite like this person's voice. I give it a listen and do my best to rank it, and then that's about it. And then occasionally I get sent a pronunciation thing where they want to just clarify that things are being pronounced correctly. Yeah, so that's it. And honestly, I don't tend to even listen to them. I think one thing is, by the point at which the book finally comes out, I've probably read it about 100 times and I'm quite sick of it. So there's that. And then the other thing is, it's an odd experience, I think, hearing my words read. I might listen to a little bit, but I certainly don't sit down and listen to the whole thing.
Have you ever considered narrating one of your own books?
God, no. First of all, I don't think I have the voice or the talent to do that. I suspect, and I've also heard, that it's much harder than people think. I think I read a story, I think it was Judi Dench, who, you know, seems like she could do anything in the acting world, went to narrate a book and found that it was very difficult for her just to maintain the quality of the voice and the breathing and get it all right and not mess up and flip back. I mean, I think it's very hard. And I, you know, as the audiobook world has boomed, I think, you know, audio narrators are in deep demand. I mean, I have no interest in doing that. I'm not really one for reading out loud myself.
Judi Dench has been on the show but her daughter is an incredible narrator, Finty Williams.
Yeah, I think I knew that. I think I must have read that. Her daughter, I think, makes her living at that and is very good. And then Judy Dench just sort of talked into it and came away with an appreciation for what her daughter does. And then also the voice work. I mean, you know, distinguishing between different voices. And this is entirely off the subject, but you mentioned Finty Williams, and she's the only other person in the world I know who has the same name as my cat. So my cat is named Finty. She's not named after Judy Dench's daughter, but they do have the same name.
Yeah, with the Christmas Guest, I think with my audio production hat on, I would have used two different voices, but they were very clever in the way that the past audio from 1989 has a sort of effect on it to make it sound older. So yeah, the audio version of Christmas Guest is really good.
Oh, I should give that a listen. I'd be curious because I knew there were some sort of challenges around doing an audio version of this book because of the different time periods and the different narrators. So I'm curious how they did it.
Now, we can't really talk much more about the Christmas Guest, but let's go back in time. When your writing got a bit meta and you wrote a sort of love letter to crime fiction. This is a book I read a couple of years ago. Rules for Perfect Murders. Tell us about Rules for Perfect Murders.
Usually my books begin with a premise and I kind of expand from there as I write. This is a book that sort of fell fully formed into my lap. I was out taking a walk through the woods and, you know, I think I was writing a short story and I was trying to come up with a clever way that someone in the story would kill someone else in the story. And I sort of began to form a list in my head of clever murders from crime fiction, you know, murders that have like a nice idea to them. My first one I think I thought of was Strangers on a Train, where you essentially swap murders. So one, you know, two people want to kill someone and you swap the murders and make sure the other person has an alibi. And I started creating this list and then instantly I thought, well, what if someone published a list of the, you know, clever murders and crime stories? And I imagined, you know, a book blogger and a bookstore owner publishing this list. And what if suddenly people started to be killed in real life using those methods from that list? And that sort of gave me a book. And it was funny because, you know, I instantly started imagining what this book would be like. And by the end of my walk, I kind of knew exactly why the murders were being done, who was doing them. I kind of knew the whole story. I mean, of course, I had to then go and write it down, but it kind of came fully formed. So, and it was, you know, it was enormously fun to write because it got to include, you know, some of my favorite books and my favorite thing, which is, you know, crime fiction.
My office was more of a nook at the back of the store. I got Agent Mulvey a chair and went around the desk and sat in my leather recliner, its stuffing bulging out from the seams. I positioned myself so that I could see her between two stacks of books. "I'm sorry," I said. "I forgot to ask if you wanted anything. There's still some coffee in the pot." "No, I'm fine," she said, removing her jacket and putting her leather bag, more of a briefcase, really, on the floor by her side. She wore a black crewneck sweater under the coat. Now that I could really see her, I realized it wasn't just her skin that was pale. It was all of her. The color of her hair, her lips, her eyelids, almost translucent. Even her glasses with their thin wire rims almost disappeared into her face. It was hard to know exactly what she looked like, almost like some artist had rubbed a thumb across her features to blur them. "Before we start, I'd like to ask you to please not discuss anything we are about to talk about with anyone. Some of it is public record, but some of it is not." "Now I'm really curious," I said, aware that my heart rate had accelerated. "And yes, absolutely, I won't tell anyone." "Great, thank you," she said, and she seemed to settle in her chair, her shoulders dropping, her head squaring with mine. "Have you heard about Robin Callahan?" she asked. Robin Callahan was a local news anchor who, a year and a half ago, had been found shot in her home in Concord, about 25 miles northwest of Boston. It had been the leading local news story since it had happened, and despite a suspicious ex-husband, no arrests had been made.
Graham Halstead reading from Rules for Perfect Murders by my guest, Peter Swanson. Now, Peter, is it important that your books are available in accessible formats such as audio?
Oh, yeah. you know, every once in a while, people come up to me, maybe at a festival or book signing or something, and they say, like, I've loved your books, but I listen to them in audio. And I mean, there's absolutely no difference between listening to a book in audio. And of course, for some people, that's the only way they can access a book, listening to an audio, reading it digitally, reading it in book form. I mean, it's all being told the story. People also say quite guiltily, you know, I got my book from the library or something like that. Like, in other words, telling me they didn't buy it. And of course, that 100%, please use your libraries. Libraries purchase my books as well, but I'm happy for anyone to use a library and read my story in any way that fit for them.
Now, one thing we won't get if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you describe the Christmas Guest cover for us?
Yeah, it's beautiful. Faber did a beautiful job. It's how I always pictured it. I mean, it's kind of a manor house, but and it's probably from a photograph, but it's, you know, and it's seen from quite a distance, and there's hedgerows, and it's sort of framed by a lovely gate that has like an old lantern on it, and, you know, bare branches reaching in on the side. And then what's quite clever about it, I mean, it already looks a little desolate and creepy, and it has this nice blood red font for the Christmas Guest. But Faber's done a very clever thing where there's snow on the ground, and in the bottom right-hand corner, there's a little splatter of blood across the snow. And in that splatter of blood, they've put their Faber logo, which is two small Fs next to each other that sort of shows up in the blood splatter. Quite beautiful.
And a nice byline at the top.
'Tis the season to be wary.
Now, it's quite a short book. Was this written to be read in one sitting, maybe in front of the fire?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, when my editor came to me and asked if I would write this book, one of the things he said is, you know, feel free. You can write a very short novel, for instance. You can make it a little different than the normal type of thing you write. But I was very, very interested in writing a short novel because, I mean, frankly, I think more novels should be short, more crime novels. It's a good novella length, short novel length is really good for a crime story. I'm always amazed. I think nowadays the typical mystery novel is probably around 80,000 words. And I think about 50 years ago, it was probably more like 50,000 words. I think Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None is about 55,000 words, and she kills 10 people in that book. So I do think you can do a lot with a short crime novel. And I do love the idea that of a sort of single sitting read, you know, maybe 2 hours, the length of a movie, and certainly because of Christmas, in front of a fire with your preferred beverage.
The Christmas Guest by Peter Swanson is out now in print, in ebook, and as an audiobook, as narrated by Esther Wayne. And Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Peter will be back at the end of the show with the books of his life. Now, let's hear about some brand new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
We have the bestseller by National Treasure, Judy Dench. It's Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent, and was donated to RNIB by Penguin Random House.
I have given suck, and know how tender it is to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out, had I so sworn as you have done to this.
Lady Macbeth.
Macbeth was the reason I went into the theatre. I saw my brother Peter play King Duncan in a school production. He had to say, "What bloody man is that?" And I thought, "My God, swearing. If this is Shakespeare, this is for me."
You've played Lady Macbeth twice.
Yes, first at Nottingham in 1963, and then we took the production to Ghana, Sierra Leone and Nigeria. Peter Brook maintained that his was the first company to tour West Africa, but in actual fact, it was ours.
Taking a curtain call with a live snake in her wake, cavorting naked through the Warwickshire countryside painted green, acting opposite a child with a pumpkin on his head. These are just a few of the things Dame Judy Dench has done in the name of Shakespeare. For the very first time, Judy opens up about every Shakespearean role she's played throughout her 7-decade career, from Lady Macbeth and Titania to Ophelia and Cleopatra. In a series of intimate conversations with actor and director Brendan O'Hare, she guides us through Shakespeare's plays with incisive clarity, revealing the secrets of her rehearsal process and inviting us to share in her triumphs, disasters, and backstage shenanigans. Interspersed with vignettes on audiences, critics, company spirit, and rehearsal room etiquette, she serves up priceless revelations on everything from the craft of speaking in verse to her personal interpretations of some of Shakespeare's most famous scenes, all brightened by her mischievous sense of humour, striking level of honesty, and a peppering of hilarious anecdotes, many of which have remained under lock and key until now. Instructive and witty, provocative and inspiring, this is ultimately Judy's love letter to Shakespeare, or rather, the man who pays the rent.
The audiences were wonderful, very vociferous. In the sleepwalking scene, a woman shouted out, "Oh my God, she's washing her hands and there's no basin!" And they loved the rhymes. They found them hilarious. The Thane of Fife had a wife, got a belter. They'd yell, "Say that bit again!" It was very taxing playing outside in the heat, though. I remember seeing vultures sitting in the trees, and I said to the actors, "For God's sake, twitch when you're dead. They're waiting to eat us." And then Polly Adams, who played one of the witches, well, her tooth blew up and she couldn't go on. A woman from the British Council offered to step in, and she knew the lines, but when it came to the spell around the cauldron, "Eye of newt and toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog," she forgot the words and said, "Wool of bat and two pork chops."
You also played Lady Macbeth for the RSC.
Trevor Nunn, 1976, at the other place in Stratford. Trevor was reluctant to be involved at first, as he'd recently directed it for the main house. But Ian McKellen and I threatened to pull out if he wasn't. There was no money. It was a very pared-back production. A circle of chalk on the floor and plain wooden orange boxes to sit on. We wore muted blacks and greys, except for King Duncan, who was all in white. I had a black dress and black boots, and it was my idea to have a black headscarf.
Were you ever frightened of the play?
Frightened?
There's often a lot of superstition surrounding Macbeth. Didn't Roger Rees break his leg at one point?
Yes, he did. Had to play Malcolm in a wheelchair. No, I don't think I'm superstitious. I don't like whistling in the dressing room, but then it's usually me doing the whistling, and I always call it the Scottish play when I'm in the theatre. We had a vicar who would occasionally sit in the front row with a crucifix, and I remember one day walking back with Trevor from the other place. Rehearsals weren't going very well. I think it was the bareness of the set, too exposing. And I said to him, "It's not going to work, is it?" And at that moment I fell off the pavement. Eventually it felt very liberating to have stripped it all back. It was alarming and terribly exciting because the audience was so close. It was very intense.
Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent by Judy Dench, is narrated by Brendan O'Hee and Barbara Flynn, and runs for 12 hours and 6 minutes.
Newly donated from Bloomsbury, we have The Convoy, HG76, Taking the Fight to Hitler's U-Boats by Angus Constam.
In May 1939, 14-year-old Florence Kelly and her mother travelled to Britain to visit relatives. Pressure of work kept her father back in Cleveland, Ohio, but mother and daughter spent the summer enjoying a holiday of a lifetime. Then, the day before they were due to return home, Hitler invaded Poland. As Britain was treaty-bound to support the Poles, there was now a real risk that the Kelly women would be caught up in the war. Still, on Saturday, 2nd September, they left Liverpool on schedule, aboard the passenger liner SS Athenia, bound for Montreal in Canada. As if to symbolise the looming threat of war, Florence noted that her cabin portholes had been painted over and blackout curtains were hung behind all doors leading onto the open deck. Still, everything seemed normal. And the following morning, Florence and her mother even attended a shipboard church service.
HG 76 sailed from Gibraltar to Britain in December 1941, and was specially targeted by the Germans. A wolf pack of U-boats was sent against it, and the Luftwaffe was heavily committed to in a rare example of German inter-service cooperation. German intelligence agents in Gibraltar and Spain also knew every detail of HG-76 before it had even sailed, seemingly stacking the odds in favour of the Kriegsmarine. Despite this, the convoy fought its way through. Improved radar and sonar gave the convoy's escorts a slight edge over their opponents, while the escort group was led by Commander Walker, an anti-submarine expert who had developed new aggressive U-boat hunting tactics. Previous Gibraltar convoys had been mauled by Luftwaffe bombers operating from French airfields. This time, though, HG-76 would be accompanied by HMS Audacity, the Royal Navy's first escort carrier, a new type of warship purpose-built to defend convoys from enemy aircraft and U-boats. Following 7 days and nights of relentless attack, the horrors of which are brought home through a series of first-hand accounts, the convoy finally reached the safety of a British port for the loss of only two merchant ships. Its arrival was seen as the first real convoy victory of the war. Brought to life by expert naval historian Angus Constam, the convoy combines the story of the technical and tactical developments that won the Battle of the Atlantic for the Allies, along with a narrative that reveals both the terror and the stubborn determination that defined the experiences of those that served on convoy duties.
Then, a little after 1100 hours, Captain Cook used the ship's speaker system to announce that Britain and Germany were now at war. It looked as if Florence and her mother had got away in the nick of time. By then, the liner was already leaving the Irish Sea and entering the Atlantic. Cook ordered the liner to make her full speed of 16 knots and to zigzag as a precaution to throw off the aim of any prowling U-boats. In mid-afternoon, he was heard telling passengers that he reckoned they would soon be far enough out into the Atlantic to be out of danger. That evening, mother and daughter ate dinner together. Afterwards, while her mother headed to the lounge to read, Florence decided to take a stroll around the deck. Walking out of the lounge, she headed for the door leading to the port side boat deck. At 1943, just as she was closing the blackout curtains behind her, the ship was rocked by an immense explosion.
The convoy, HG-76, taking the fight to Hitler's U-boats, by Angus Constam, is read by Philip Pope and runs for 10 hours 17 minutes.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. Back in the days of recording to tape, sometimes the narrators were asked to go a little bit faster.
We looked at the tape, we looked at the book, we looked at the amount of tape we had, and there's a chapter heading coming up in a page and a half time. You've got 3 minutes. Can you speed up a little bit? We're not going, it wasn't quite that bad, but we did tend to try and speed up a little bit.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
More brand new books in a moment, but for now, let's hear from comedian Tony Hawkes. Three of his books are available from RNIB: Round Ireland with a Fridge, One Hit Wonderland, and Playing the Moldovans at Tennis, which is also a movie.
I have to beat the entire Moldovan national football team at tennis, one by one.
You are very optimistic.
It's always a good idea to have a visual picture of what your challenge is.
This is the list of the players that you need to play.
Sounds easy. Should be out of here within the week.
and Tony Hawks joins me now.
Now, this was your second book, and as with Round Ireland with a Fridge, it started as a bet.
It did, yeah. It's a bizarre story, really. We were watching England play Moldova in the World Cup qualifiers on the TV, myself and my friend Arthur Smith. I'd been playing tennis, so I was sitting there in tennis kit. Out of the blue, he just said, "I don't reckon you're that good at tennis, Tony. I don't reckon you could beat. I don't reckon you could beat all those footballers we're watching." And I said, "I thought I could, because footballers aren't known for being very good at tennis." And we got into a genuine argument about this. And he said, "Look, I bet you couldn't beat them." And I said, "It's a silly bet. I'd never be able to play the England players. They'd never agree to play me. They've got managers, agents. I'd never be able to reach them." He said, "All right, I bet you couldn't beat the entire Moldovan team. They won't have managers and agents. And what's more, if you do beat them, I'll strip naked on Ballymy Road and sing the Moldovan national anthem." And so I thought, well, this sounds like an adventure. I think I was probably, I'd done Round Ireland with a Fridge. I'd had an amazing time. It was a very interesting thing to go off and do something quite wacky and silly. And this appealed to me, you know, the idea of going to a country I knew nothing about. We had to look it up on the map to see where it was. And then and go with this challenge, you know, to track down the 11 footballers that had played in this match and ask them to play me at tennis. And the adventure began like that.
Now, to find out if you did it or not, you're going to have to listen to the book. But Arthur Smith, I believe, laid some traps for you along the way.
Yes, it wasn't all as his behaviour lacked dignity, one might say. Without giving too much away, after a very, very sticky start, things started to go better. And then there was a certain amount of subterfuge sort of took place, and I don't want to say too much, as you mentioned, it can spoil it. But you'll have to listen to find out what it is that happens.
Now, at the start of this journey, did you think it would have such a philanthropic effect on you, which is lasting to this day?
Not at all, no. I mean, I went there, you know, hoping to have a big adventure, fun adventure, and write a book about it. I did, unlike Round Ireland with the Fridge, where I just went on this sort of whim and the story emerged, it became a book. This one I was commissioned by publishers, and so it was almost like my job for that period of time to go and track down footballers. But when I got there, I ended up with a sort of moral dilemma, because Moldova was then and is still the poorest country in Europe. I saw a lot of poverty, I saw a lot of people suffering, and I felt like the people I'd stayed with, the two doctors who were lovely people, hadn't been paid for 6 months. People were sitting on the streets selling things like, you know, one item of clothing or just a fish that they'd caught. And I hadn't really been close, particularly in Europe, to that kind of poverty. And I thought, God, this is difficult because, you know, what am I doing? I'm swanning in here as this relatively super rich Westerner. I'm going to get my story and I'm going to go back to UK and profit from it. So I made a decision, you know, almost thinking, well, there's only one way to make this fair, and that would be to share whatever royalties I get with Moldova in some way. So all the royalties from the book have always gone into a fund, and it's been split 50-50 between me and a trust fund for Moldova. And fortunately, the book did well enough for us to buy a property. I went back to the doctors and said, "Look, I've got this money, what can we do with it?" And they said, "Well, we need to open a centre for kids with cerebral palsy. We get them all referred to us and we can't do anything for them." And the state at that time just said, "You've got to put them in a home. We'd like these families to be able to keep their children." So we set up this care centre, and it's been going on for 10 years now. I've made a film, and we're going to give the profits of that, all the profits of that, to this care centre. So it's an ongoing thing.
One thing I wondered about the film, why did Arthur Smith become Stephen Frost?
Ah, very good point. Well, Arthur, I don't know whether you've met him or know him, but he certainly appeared a few times on a programme called Grumpy Old Men. And he's got really good at it. And I phoned him up and asked him if he'd like to play himself in the film. And I got him on a morning when he was particularly grumpy. And he said, "Oh, I can be bothered, Hawks. I really are. No, I've too much on my plate. Can you get someone else? I can't be bothered. He just couldn't be bothered, really. I think he'd had a bad. But whether I'd chased him and really pushed him, he would have done it. I think I probably could have persuaded him. But it was a project where I thought, well, if you don't want to do it, don't do it. I don't want to sort of have to bully you. And I rang Steve, and he's from the same era, Stephen Frost. You know, he's an old mate of mine, and he's almost the kind of guy that would have done that. He was a fantastic substitute for Arthur. It was a great shame he didn't do it, but he also hasn't done a lot of acting, and although he's a fantastic comedian, Steve's done a lot more acting, and it may well have been that he didn't want to take that on either.
And not saying who, but is there any nudity at the end?
Aha, there is, but we have carefully shot it. It's mostly shot from it's shot from the rear, and
as it were,
it's carefully done. It's tastefully done. Yeah,
from the archives, that's friend of the show, Tony Hawks. Three of his books are available from Talking Books: Round Ireland with a Fridge, Playing the Moldovans at Tennis, and One Hit Wonderland. Now, before we hear The Books of Your Life from author Peter Swanson, let's return to the RNIB Talking Books Library for some more new gems.
If you're already in the mood for Christmas, we have The Christmas Book Club by Sarah Morgan, which was given to us by HarperCollins.
Maple Sugar Inn, how may I help you? Hattie answered the phone with a smile on her face because she discovered that it was impossible to sound defeated, moody, or close to tears when you were smiling. And currently, she was all those things. I've been planning a trip to Vermont in winter for years, and then I spotted pictures of your inn on social media, a woman gushed, and it looks so cozy and welcoming, the type of place you can't help but relax. It's an illusion, Hattie thought. There was no relaxation to be had here, not for her at any rate. Her head throbbed and her eyes pricked following another night without sleep. The head housekeeper was threatening to walk out, and the executive chef had been late two nights running, and she was worried tonight might be the third, which would be a disaster because they were fully booked. Chef Tucker had earned their restaurant that coveted star, and his confit of duck had been known to induce moans of ecstasy from diners. But there were days when Hattie would have traded that star for a chef with a more even temperament. His temper was so hot, she sometimes wondered why he bothered switching on the grill. He could have yelled at the duck and it would have been thoroughly singed in the flames of his anger.
Every year, Erica, Claudia, and Anna reunite for their book club holiday. They're bonded by years of friendship and a deep love of books, but there is still so much they keep from each other. At the cosy Maple Sugar Inn, Hattie specialises in making her guests' dreams come true, but this Christmas all she wants is to survive the festive season. Between running the inn and being a single mother, Hattie is close to breaking point. Over the course of an eventful week, Hattie sees that the friends are each carrying around unspoken truths, but nothing prepares her for how deeply her story will become intertwined with theirs. Will this Christmas be the end of the book club story, or the start of a whole new chapter?
He was being disrespectful and taking advantage of her. Hattie knew that, and she also knew she should probably fire him. But Brent had chosen him, and firing him would have severed another thread from the past. Also, conflict drained her energy, and right now she didn't have enough of that to go around. It was simpler to placate him. I'm glad you're impressed, she said to the woman on the phone. Can I make a reservation for you? I hope so, but I'm very particular about the room. Can I tell you what I need? Of course. Bracing herself for a long and unachievable wish list, Hattie resisted the temptation to smack her forehead onto the desk. Instead, she reached for a pad of paper and pen that was always handy. Go ahead. How bad could it be? A woman the week before had wanted to know if she could bring her pet rat with her on vacation. Answer, no. And a man the week before that had demanded that she turn down the sound of the river that ran outside his bedroom window because it was keeping him awake. She went above and beyond in her attempts to satisfy the whims of guests, but there were limits. "I'd like the room to have a mountain view," the woman said, "and a real fire would be a nice extra." "All our rooms have real fires," Hattie said, "and the rooms at the back have wonderful views of the mountains. The ones at the front face the river." She relaxed slightly. "So far, so straightforward. Mountains for me. Also, I'm particular about bedding. After all, we spent a third of our lives asleep, so it's important. Don't you agree?" Hattie felt a twinge of envy. She definitely didn't spend a third of her life asleep. With having a young child, owning an inn, and grieving the loss of her husband, she barely slept at all. She dreamed of sleep, but sadly, usually when she was awake.
The Christmas Book Club by Sarah Morgan is read by Dara Rosenberg and runs for 10 hours 51 minutes.
If you enjoyed The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, we have the latest book in that series, The Girl in the Eagle's Talons by Karen Smirnoff, which was donated by MacLehose Press.
The cleaner keeps an eye on his watch. From the moment he baits the feeding tray with hunks of meat, it takes 41 seconds for the first eagle, a female, to land. He can never tell exactly where it has come from. It could have been perched in a nearby tree, or sailing a couple of thousand meters above. With eyesight like that, 200 times sharper than a human's, it can zoom in on prey from several kilometers away. He is sitting 50 meters from the bait, well concealed in his hiding place, following the meal through his binoculars. 14 across, raptor treats. 5, 5. Eagle candy. The tenderness he feels for the birds is not fatherly love, for what does he know of that? And yet, he cannot help thinking of them as his children.
Change is coming to Sweden's far north. Its untapped natural resources are sparking a gold rush with the criminal underworld leading the charge. But it's not the prospect of riches that brings Lisbeth Salander to the small town of Kaskas. She's been named guardian to her niece Svala, whose mother has disappeared. Two things soon become clear. Svala is a remarkably gifted teenager, and she's being watched. Mikael Blomkvist is also heading north. He's seen better days. Millennium magazine is in its final print issue, and relations with his daughter are strained. Worse still, there are still troubling rumours surrounding the man she's about to marry. When the truth behind the whispers explodes into violence, Salander emerges as Blomkvist's last hope. A pulse-pounding thriller, The Girl in the Eagle's Talons sees Salander and Blomkvist navigating a world of conspiracy and betrayal, old enemies and new friends, snowbound wilderness, and the global corporations that threaten to tear it apart.
He thinks about them before he goes to sleep, the moment he wakes up, as he goes about all the essential chores like chopping wood, preparing their meals, or lighting the fire. He thinks about them. Have they mated? Have the young survived? Can they find enough to eat? Will they make it through the winter? Yes, with his help and a decent year for voles, they will pull through. He rubs his knuckles over his eyes. The sun has risen higher now and is warming his back, maybe for the last time this autumn. It doesn't matter. This house is in a corner of the world forgotten by humankind. Although, house is a bit of an exaggeration. A log hut that has stood empty since the last foresters left in the early 1960s and the area was designated a national park. This is rugged country with its irregular structure of ancient forest, meres, bogs, and mountains. There is no proper road leading to it either. Apart from animal parts, the only visible markers are the faint traces of an old forest track that nature is busily reclaiming. The only way to get there is on foot or by quad bike, and you have to know the route. It's a good 10 kilometers from the nearest public road, and he limits his movement to a radius of a couple of kilometers around the hut. When he first came here, he marked directions with branches so he wouldn't get lost. This local territory provides him with a stream to fish in, fallen trees for his woodpile, and convenient clearings where he can look out for birds and smaller game.
The Girl in the Eagle's Talons by Karen Smirnoff is narrated by Katya Mohamar and runs for 12 hours 22 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor, and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports talking books.
This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. This is Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. And finally, on today's show, a return to Peter Swanson for the books of his life.
Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Many. Roald Dahl was probably my favorite author. But probably my favorite book was by John Bellairs, a book called The House with a Clock in Its Walls, which was kind of a supernatural story about a young orphan who's brought to his uncle's house. And there are, of course, mysterious goings on in this house, including a huge number of clocks that tick-tock all around the house and that seem to obsess the uncle. Anyway, it was a book that fell apart in my hands. I'd read it so many times. And John Bellairs went on to write, he wrote many very good books, but that one was my favorite by far.
Louis Barneveld fidgeted and wiped his sweaty palms on the seat of the bus that was roaring toward New Zebedee. It was a warm, windy summer evening. Outside, that is. Louis could see the moonlit trees tossing gently beyond his window, which was sealed shut like all the windows on the bus. He looked down at his purple corduroy trousers, the kind that go whip-whip when you walk. He put his hand up and rubbed it across his hair, which was parted in the middle and slicked down with wild root cream oil. His hand was greasy now, so he wiped it on the seat again. His lips were moving, and he was saying a prayer. He tried to remember more prayers, but he could only come up with questions. It seemed to Louis that all he could think of these days were questions. Where am I going? Who will I meet? Will I like them? What will happen to me? Louis Barneveld was 10 years old. Until recently, he had lived with his parents in a small town near Milwaukee. But his father and mother had been killed suddenly one night in a car accident, and now Louis was on his way to New Zebedee, the county seat of Capharnaum County in the state of Michigan. He was going to live with his Uncle Jonathan, whom he had never met in his life. Of course, Louis had heard a few things about Uncle Jonathan, like that he smoked and drank and played poker. Louis had two maiden aunts, and they had warned him about Jonathan. He hoped that the warnings would turn out to be unnecessary. As the bus rounded a curve, Louis looked at his reflection in the window next to his seat. He saw a moony, fat face with shiny cheeks. The lips on the face were moving. Louis was saying the prayers again, this time with the wish that they might make Uncle Jonathan like him.
The House with a Clock in Its Walls by John Bellairs is available from RNIB Talking Books as read by Christopher Ragland. And is there a book on a rainy day you curl up again to reread?
It's funny, my all-time favorite book, all-time favorite genre is crime fiction. My all-time favorite book is not crime fiction. It is Lucky Jim by Kingsley Amis. It's a book that consistently makes me laugh out loud ever since I first read it in college. I've probably read it every year since. And it is truly a comfort book for me. Maybe it's because Jim Dixon, the character in the book, is quite hapless and makes me feel better about my own life. But it's just a very funny comic masterpiece. I always have a copy. I have several copies, but I always have a copy near me at all times.
And then, just before I went under, I suddenly stopped caring. I'd been clutching the empty bottle like grim death, I remember, as if I were holding on to life in a way. But quite soon I didn't in the least mind going. I felt too tired somehow. And yet if someone had shaken me and said, "Come on, you're not going, you're coming back," I really believe I should have started trying to make the effort, trying to get back. But nobody did. And so I just thought, "Oh well, here we go. It doesn't matter all that much." Curious sensation. Margaret Peel, small, thin, and bespectacled, with bright makeup, glanced at Dixon with a half smile. Around them was the grumble of half a dozen conversations. "It's a good sign that you're able to talk about it like this," he said. Since she made no reply, he went on, "What happened afterwards, or can't you remember? Don't tell me if you'd rather not, of course." "No, I don't mind telling you if it won't bore you." Her smile broadened a little. "But didn't Wilson tell you about how he found me?" "Wilson? Oh, the chap in the room underneath. Yes, he said about hearing your wireless booming away and coming up to complain. What made you leave it on like that?" The feelings aroused in him by the first part of Margaret's story had almost subsided now, and he was able to think more clearly. She looked away across the half-empty bar. "I don't really know, James," she said. "I think I had some idea about wanting to have some sort of noise going on while I was going off. It seemed so horribly quiet in that room." She gave a little shiver and said quickly, "A bit chilly in here, isn't it?" "We'll move if you like." No, it's all right, just a bit of a draught with that chap coming in. Oh, yes, afterwards. I think I grasped quite soon what was going on and where I was and all that, and what they were doing to me. I thought, oh, God, hours and hours of feeling ill and wretched, can I bear it?
Lucky Jim by Kingsley Amis is available from RNIB Library in both audio and braille. The audio version is read by Franklin Engelman. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Yeah, I mean, I read a lot of contemporary crime fiction. The one that really impressed me was Janice Hallett, The Appeal. It's a murder mystery that is told entirely through emails and texts and DMs and IMs. And she pulls it off sort of spectacularly. It's all centered around a village regional theater. I was amazed how suspenseful it was, but also how funny it was and how much you got a sense of the characters just through the way they wrote their emails and texts.
From Isabel Beck. Subject: sorry. Date: 26th of March, 2018, at 6:39. To Martin Haywood. Dear Martin, sorry to bother you. I couldn't speak to Helen at last night's rehearsal. Could you pass a message on, please? A new girl at work, Sam, is coming to see the play on Saturday night. I'd love her to join Fairways. She hasn't done any drama before and spent the last few years in Africa, of all places. But she's got a husband and we should grab them both while they're still new to the area and friendless. She's very nice, a staff nurse in geriatrics. So a shift worker, boo. But her husband is probably the same age, 30s? And Helen has said how badly we need men, especially if we do All My Sons next. This is just in case Helen speaks to them after the play, so she knows to be in full promotional mode. Thanks, Martin. Love, Izzy.
From Martin Haywood. Subject, re-sorry. Date, the 26th of March, 2018, at 18:16. To Isabel Beck. Will do. Regards.
From Isabel Beck. Subject, the morning after. Date, 1st of April, 2018, at 10:45. To Martin Haywood. Dear Martin, phew, thank goodness that's over. Not that I didn't love being Edith the maid, I did, but fitting rehearsals and line learning around shifts is like trying to live two lives at the same time. Anyway, Sam loved the play. I don't think they are regular theatre-goers because she asked if we'd written it. I explained it was by Noel Coward. Helen spoke to Sam and her husband, Kelly, and if anyone can convince them to join, she can. Wasn't Helen an absolute shining star? All my friends remarked on how brilliant she was. No one knows how she manages to chair the Fairway Players, run the Grange, and still learn all those lines. She must have a lot of support from you, Martin. Do send my best wishes to Paige and James. You were all so busy last night, I didn't get a chance to speak to you. What a lovely family. Thanks again. And let's hope Sam and Kel become Fairway Players for the next production. Love, Izzy.
From Martin Haywood. Subject, the morning after. Date, the 1st of April, 2018, at 19:32. To Isabel Beck. Thanks. Regards.
The Appeal by Janice Hallett is available commercially, as read by Isha Kala, Daniel Philpott, Rachel Adedigi, and Sid Segar. And Peter Swanson, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert. Pleasure.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, there are over 350 episodes in our podcast feed. Just type Read On, RNIB, into your favourite podcast app.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.